my name is Dave Hanrady and there will be no encore, but there will be a revisit as we travel back to the year 1984, the year of my birth, a very, very special time, and also a special time perhaps in Irish music, certainly in world music for sure. To celebrate this grand occasion, I am joined today by Selena Murphy of the Irish Daily Star and Buzz.ie.
Hello.
How are you?
Good.
Thank you for joining us.
You're so welcome.
We also have James Byrne, who has banged the drums for various outfits across the years, including Villagers, Soak, and many more. How are you, sir?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. And we also have Eamon Sweeney of Hot Press, Irish Independent, The Quietus, and some sick DJ skills as well.
How are you? Thank you very much. That's very flattering of you. But well, I'm very well. Pleasure to be here.
And of course, Kieran McGuinness of De Laurentiis fame is also with us. How are you, sir?
What's up, man?
Not a lot, man.
Cool.
84 was a big year for music, particularly across the world. And what else was happening in general pop culture terms?
Well, pop culture, Ghostbusters, Indiana Jones, The Temple of Doom, Gremlins, Beverly Hills Cop, Karate Kid. I mean, the films of, you know, the 80s came out that year, it seems. But Terms of Endearment won the Oscar, randomly. I don't know anything about that. Apparently it's a weepy.
It's devastating, yeah.
Yeah, it's devastating that it won, or it's devastating.
It's a devastating picture. Okay. Deborah Winger, you know.
It's garbage.
I haven't seen it in a long time.
And then the LA Olympics, Yugoslavia was the winter summer Olympics. AIDS was first identified. The first Apple Mac, MTV Awards started. Band Aid happened. You know, tons of stuff like that. And then in albums, Reckoning, R.E.M., Van Halen in 1984. A personal favorite of Selena, Wham, make it big.
Oh, so good!
Wow.
Born in the USA, Sade.
Gotta lean into it.
We all have a different pronunciation of it, I think. Kind of like.
Yeah. So Sade, Diamond Life, and then loads and loads of Irish albums. Any other albums that I missed there? You had the Replacements?
Let It Be by The Replacements.
Okay, awesome.
Double Nickels on the Dime by The Minutemen. My War by Black Flag.
I didn't have any.
Purple Rain, Prince of the Revolution.
Oh, sorry. Purple Rain was 1984. And Ride the Lightning by
Metallica.
Yeah.
Smith's Hatful of Hollow, or did you say that?
Hatful of Hollow, yeah.
That'd be a big one for me.
That's a B-side album, right?
Technically, yes. But the Smiths never put out any bad material. Like, even all the B-sides, the quality control was just sensational. And it's essentially cobbled together Peel sessions. But it just flows like an album. It's absolutely extraordinary. And I think it's kind of rightly regarded almost as an album in its own right. But even the other Smiths compilations, like The World Won't Listen and Louder Than Bombs.
I would think that's just amazing, because they seem to have an album every year. And they'd have their own album, and then they'd have like a, you know, B-sides album.
Yeah.
This is the thing, you know, because of, you know, the way the internet, you know, the way the internet has ruined music for everyone. The way, you know, releasing doesn't happen anymore. You know, that kind of... The need to have a physical thing out.
Sure.
You know, it's, and that would be the first time you'd hear it, because obviously now everyone's B-sides are, you know, you can hear them whenever you want, or they're on.
Kind of bleeds into one, really.
Yeah, it's uploaded onto YouTube or whatever, and it's not like a physical thing. But anyway.
Yeah, it was an embarrassment to riches across the board. If you just look up 1984 music on Wikipedia, it's absolutely stacked. And granted, they would pick the most notable entries, but it's quite ridiculous. On the home front, though, Kier, we have 5 albums on this shortlist and a couple of surprises that didn't quite make it. Where should we start?
Well, I'll go through the 5 albums. We have The Pogues, Red Roses for Me, their debut. We had Micro Disney, Everybody is Fantastic, their debut. We had Man on the Line by Christa Berg, his 7th album. We had Silent Running, Shades of Liberty, their first album. And then we had a band from Northside Dublin, a 4-piece called U2, The Unforgettable Fire.
Revisit regulars, U2.
We should be paying them. They should be paying us. Somebody should be paying something.
I tried to bring in some Christy Moore here, but it didn't quite happen.
Well, Christy Moore was your choice, and you were devastated. You were saying
I was devastated. No, Christy Moore, because like the whole point of the revisit. Well, one of the points of the revisit is to look at stuff that you might otherwise have either dismissed or not really spent too much time with. And I can't say I'm the biggest Christy Moore guy. I mean, if there's a trad session happening in a pub, I'm probably the guy that's nearest the exit. Even though I respect it greatly, it's just not quite my thing. And the Christy Moore album, I gave it a go, did my best. It has its moments, you know, right on to belter. But overall, I don't know. I mean, like it hasn't converted me, but I can see totally why it would be poetry to some people. But I will say I'm surprised it didn't make it, and I'm kind of a little bit sad it didn't make it, because I think it would have kind of given us a bit more flavour. But then again, there's a bit of an underlying theme to this episode, which surprised me. But we'll get there when we get there.
Well, I was really surprised. It's a weird year, 1984. It was a weird year in Irish music. There was a lot of U2 going on. There was Silent Running, which is like the Nordy Simple Minds U2. They got in, and then there was Zero One, which is the gothy, you know, version of U2, which didn't get in. I think maybe that's a bit reductive, but the reality is that sound, that early 80s sound that so many bands are doing, it's like represented. So Silent Running got the other version of U2 in, and Zero One didn't. But some of their songs sounded, you know, very, very U2-y.
Well, you sound like an expert, so we should probably start there. Let's have a listen to what U2
sounded before like. Can I just throw in that Auto Da Fe didn't get in? And I thought that was an interesting album. It was kind of weird. It was like a Danish-Irish band. A Dutch-Irish band called Auto Da Fe. They almost nothing online, very, very little. But you could patch together an album from YouTube videos and, you know, things like that, you know, other links or whatever. And Phil Lynott was involved. He sang on two songs. I think he produced a couple of songs. And you know something, I don't know if it was better than what we have in the list, but it was, you know, sort of interesting anyway, you know.
Well, now you know how I feel about Christy Moore, so there you go. But we'll get to the Unforgettable Fire, which sounds like this. Pride in the Name of Love, U2. Are they the best version of U2 then from that year, Kier?
Yes, I don't know, but it's. I think it's a really. It's a better album than I thought. Looking into the history of it's really interesting. So it's their fourth album, and it's after kind of War and Boy in October, which I suppose were kind of reasonably standard rock records, I suppose, and written about themselves and their own lives, you know. I think War has Gloria on it, which has got Bible verses in it. October has got, you know, their own kind of, that's about their own struggles or whatever. All those kind of songs are about themselves. And they started with Sunday Bloody Sunday kind of getting a bit political. But then you get to this album and it was recorded in Slane Castle. It's got two songs for MLK. The title's about, you know, the Hiroshima, the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you know, Pride in the Name of Love, obviously MLK as well, and lots of songs either mentioning America, like Elvis and America, or like stuff about it. So they're starting to look outside, they're starting to change their sound, they're trying to develop. And I think it's a really, I don't know, it's an interesting album. I was reading about Eno. The Edge really wanted to work with Brian Eno, and Brian Eno was having none of it. And they played, you know, they were like, we'll play him Under a Blood Red Sky, you know, the concert film. And his eyes glazed over, apparently, and he was having none of it. And also there's a quote from Adam Clayton who said, we were looking to do something more arty. And I think saying, you know, the indistinct nature of saying that you want to do something more arty. But they got him in, and I think his, you know, what he does is all over it. So there's some brilliant songs, and Unforgettable Fire is a brilliant song. I don't really know that song, and it's absolutely brilliant. Mm-hmm. MLK is a gorgeous song, and there's a song called Indian Summer Sky, which actually is just a revelation. I never heard it before. It's absolutely brilliant. And then, of course, there's Pride in the Name of Love, which just overshadows everything.
Yeah, I mean, like, it overshadows everything to the point where I wonder, you know, to use the obvious kind of pun, is this a forgettable U2 album, like, in terms of their entire canon?
It could be. I was surprised by how little of the songs. You know, you think you'd know... I would assume that I would know a lot of U2 songs. I knew Pride and I knew Bad, which are both from this album. And to be honest with you, I didn't, like, other than that, I knew nothing. And it was kind of weird because, yeah, you just expect to know a load of the, you know, the actual songs on the U2 album.
Like Off By Heart type thing?
It's more of a kind of moody, like, it's a very kind of rich, moody, kind of ambient kind of record almost in places. And, like, you can really, the Brian Eno and Daniel Anne Watt thing, like, really comes to the surface. Like, it's probably the most textured U2 album I can think of. And what I really like about it is refreshing, with probably the exception, of course, with Pride and maybe Bad. It's probably the least bombastic U2 album you'll ever hear.
I totally agree with that, yeah.
And for what it's worth, it's a record I really, really liked. I remember actually kind of, well, I would have been too young to have heard it when it came out, but remember kind of a few years later being played to me. And it certainly would have been one of the first rock records that I was aware of. And I know all the hype this year is about the Joshua Tree and coming to Crow Park and all that kind of stuff, but for what it's worth, I prefer this one, and I prefer Octone Baby, and I prefer Boy, and a lot of the other U2 stuff. Leaves me pretty cold, to be honest. But that's my tuppence worth.
I think it, of all their albums, to me, it's one that kind of works best as a record from start to finish. It doesn't have as many kind of hits as Joshua Tree, I guess. They definitely sound a little less desperate on it than the first three. I think they got to a certain level of success, saw America, thought, well, we don't have to try as hard to make it, we're making it. Let's chill out a bit, let's kind of make music for ourselves a bit more. But I think it might be it and maybe Joshua, or it and Octane Baby are from my favourite U2 records. But again, it's like, I think if you were 17, 18 in the mid-80s in Ireland and you had a band making a record like that and it was suddenly the biggest thing, it would be huge. I can see why generationally they're such a big band for a lot of people. But to me, obviously, I was like 2 or 3 years old when it came out.
Yeah,
you don't, you miss that, and then it's coming to you second hand, like, you gotta hear this record, it's incredible. And maybe the impact of it is lost because it doesn't seem like as big a deal. It's just it's a good record, it's a good rock record, and you get the fact that no Irish band had kind of gotten that big before. But I think a lot of the kind of legendary status it and a lot of their kind of mid-80s records have is because at the time it was such a big deal, it was so unusual. But I don't know, I've seen documentaries about the making of it and Joshua Tree and stuff, and it seems like they were actually really into making the album. They really enjoyed the process.
Well, it's interesting because, like, I think it's MLK, I'm pretty sure, is the first track is sort of Homecoming, slow down loads, and then you know it's Bono singing over it, you know, and like, you know, a kind of a groove from Larry, and then they have Elvis and America, which is Bono kind of, you know, it's just singing over like music, you know. Now it sounds it's funny because it sounds quite loose at times, and as well the 4th of July, which is an instrumental on the album, was written in the studio just, you know, while they were jamming it. So it's kind of, I know, it's like, it's kind of cool to hear that, you know. Like this, as I say, Elvis in America, that song does sound a bit all over the shop. It doesn't sound very together, it's kind of waffly and a bit meandery. And but it's good that they hear that, because now you imagine that a U2 album is so, it's so poured over, you know. I can't imagine everything that they do is so poured over.
But they were
over.
Still on the come up, yeah. You know, and only on the Joshua Tree did they become the biggest band in the world. And when they got there, they're so afraid of not being there anymore. They just frantically, it started sounding really thirsty again. Really, like, we got to keep our position. And all the music made after that, even Octane Baby, which is a great record, it still has that, you know, we can't lose our position, guys. We have to keep being the biggest band in the world. And eventually now it's petered out because they grew up. But at the time, it doesn't sound like a record made by a band that is trying to stay in the position. It still sounds like they're trying to discover themselves a bit and kind of branch out. Okay, Joshua Tree is a very different sounding record, though. I think Joshua Tree, on the success of Unforgettable Fire, they became massive. Or more massive, especially in America.
I can hear a lot of that, though. I mean, I never thought of this before, but I just from looking at the first three, you can nearly take the first three albums as a block, you know, of a world, and then the next three albums, which is this one, Joshua Tree and Rattling Home, similar world, and then you could go again for the next three, which is Acting Baby and Zooropa and Pop. You could say
more European almost, if you like, in a way. Yeah, I'm sure.
Well, the middle two are real American sounding. This is
the beginning.
Let's sell records in America. We're going to get richer, boys. But that's the other thing. As great a band as they are, they're you know, they want a bit of money. They want to be like, there's no shame in that.
Yeah,
of like, let's be bigger. What can we do to become a bigger band? And not necessarily a better band. Let's be bigger first, and better maybe comes slightly secondary. And Joshua Tree, definitely, it's like, let's be bigger.
Selena, what's your relationship with U2?
Well, I wasn't born in 1984.
Well, you know, we can't all have that distinction. But
yeah, I mean, that's kind of your thing, Dave. I've realised that U2 are just like wallpaper to me. Like, when I was born, my brother had all these U2 albums in the house and bought probably every subsequent U2 album. And even when I was listening to Unforgettable Fire for this podcast, was finding myself like trying to force myself to have opinions, and my opinions were like, this is a very U2-y song and Bono sounds so Bono-y here. Ballad, like ballad, I think yeah. it's actually one of those things where they've been so omnipresent in my life that I'm like barely able to react. I felt that it was quite mixed for me. There were some songs where I was like, oh, okay, I could see liking this. And there was some songs where I was like, this has to be filler. Everyone listening to this has to be identifying it as filler. But I mean, I might be completely incorrect.
No, I actually think, I think there's a couple of clear fillers in it. But I think that's okay. It's nice to hear filler on a U2 album. I kind of feel like later on, everything is just really kind of thought about, you know. So in that way, it's kind of good to hear them experiment.
They do feel kind of loose on it, or like
yeah, there's something organic about it. Definitely. Yeah, yeah.
Mm. Isn't it weird though contrived. That was their fourth album? If that was a band today, they would have been dropped after their first record because it didn't sell a lot.
And it took
them.
October.
It took them like five albums to become the biggest band in the world, and that was over whatever 6 years. And nowadays, like, it just wouldn't happen. They wouldn't. YouTube wouldn't have existed because after
was
one
was Island a big label?
Yeah,
it was. Huge. Big album.
When did they signed?
Grace Jones to Bob Marley.
Okay.
To,
so they would have been pressure on them.
Yeah, but they were obviously like, okay, guys, it's growing. It's growing. But like, first album, it had done what it did, like nowadays, and kind of in the same kind of scale. They might not have been given a second record. It might not have even come out. You can imagine it just coming out in Ireland and we'll see how it does, boys. Whereas at that stage, it was like, three albums in, then keep going, it's growing, we like it, it's building, records are selling, you need to develop. They only developed into the band they were going to be like four or five albums in, and it's insane to think what would have happened if you two had been dropped after the first album and maybe broken up, and what would have happened to the great what if is like, what if you two hadn't taken over the 80s? Where's Irish music now without this giant like Zeppelin hanging over the Irish music scene? Big bands at the time in America especially were like kind of rock and roll bands trying to be kind of edgy and dangerous, and you two are like, you can bring them home to your parents kind of band, really nice. Like, they read the Bible, they're not going to never get in fights, none of them drink heavily, they're clean cut boys, and you know, that's more acceptable, you know. And maybe in a similar way to, like, I guess a modern band like Mumford and Sons or something have all of that as well, and it's just, it's not going to scare you, it's easy to get, it's easy to understand. And you know, maybe they knew that as well, like, look, we have something to offer us not being edgy rock stars, let's play up the normalness and the purity of what we're doing.
It's a really good point. And when you think about it, when they became rock stars, it was the irony thing. It was the Mephisto, it was Zoo TV, it was all kind of like acting like the fantasy of being a rock star rather than actually being a rock star and getting arrested like one of the Gallagher brothers or whatever.
Like nowadays, like you have an idea of if a band is good or if a band is hip or cool. I'm sure in the early 80s, you two were seen as a hip band, or were they? I don't know if you two were ever like a band people were like will admit to being into if they're kind of cool musicians. Whereas I'm sure by this time, people are looking at them as this kind of unhip band. And maybe they just embrace us like, we're never going to be cool lads, but we're going to be massive.
Well, as ever, it's impossible to talk about you two without getting too into Bono. But Ireland has a history of producing unique showmen, one of whom is named Chris de Burgh. Man the Line, and I'm glad I didn't go full Alan Partridge with my Chris de Burgh intro there, which I could easily have done. Selena Murphy, is Chris de Burgh, you know, worth comparing to Bono? Is he, you know, a kind of a really gigantic showman in his own right? And also, is there more to the man than Lady in Red? Is the real question I would ask.
First question, I would say, dear Lord, I don't know. And the second question, I would say yes. So I had pretty much only heard Lady in Red that I could name off the top of my head as Chris de Burgh record. And I looked at this on our long list of albums and I thought, like, simultaneously, I won't like this and I will definitely like this. I won't like this because Lady in Red is awful. In my opinion, I once got into a taxi wearing a red dress, and the taxi man actually reached over me to get into the glove compartment to take out Christa Berg's CD to put it on.
Jesus Christ.
So I have a personal aversion to the song. Nice. Sorry if anyone listening
was it Christa Berg?
Oh my God, it was. So I was like, I'm probably not going to like this. And on the other hand, I've had like a warming of the heart towards kind of man-led, like schmaltz pop over the past couple of years, like the Neil Sedakas and the Barry Manilows. So I thought, you know what, maybe I will like this. And I ended up loving it, like really loving this. It's not like a very cool album. It's not very consistent. It's not perfect. It's 10 tracks. It's 40 minutes long. It's really neat. Mm-hmm. And what I think has happened here is somebody has come along and cherry-picked like the best things about Christa Berg and put them all really like comfortably on one album. And I realised that when I started thinking, I like Man on the Line. Maybe I'll like Christa Berg's other 80s material. I don't. I certainly don't. And I kind of have this theory. There's a guy who worked on Man on the Line. He's the arranger. He plays synths, keys, orchestral arrangement, and produced the whole album. And he's called Rupert Hine. I haven't heard of him before, but he worked with people like Rush and Underworld, really random list of people. And he worked on this album with Chris and the previous one, The Getaway, which is the only other album that I found any songs of Christa Berg's that I actually liked. I feel like this guy, I mean, sorry, Chris, if I'm not giving you any credit for the album I'm saying I really like that you made, but I think this guy might have come along and really recognised what the fun parts of Christa Berg could be, and like a Melody. Beautiful puppet master made it happen. I mean, like, I listened to the album, thought, oh, I'm really into this. I'm bopping around my kitchen listening to it. Like, I thought, you know what? Maybe I just want to like this album to be contrary. So I left it for 3 days. And in those 3 days, about 4 of the songs were stuck in my head. And when I came back, I had to admit to myself that I did genuinely really like it. There's a certain amount of irony in my appreciation of this album because there are so many weird things on it. Yeah, but what I learned...
like Christa Berg.
I mean, the central weird thing is Christa Berg, who is an enigma.
Wrapped in a riddle.
But what I learned, again, from like randomly just clicking on other songs on YouTube of his, was that the things that he's got, like 4 things that he does, I've learned. And it's soppy ballads. It's kind of epic, very radio friendly pop with loads of keys. There's another thing he does, which is this kind of gross, look how much compassion I have for humanity kind of song, where he's like, Jesus. And like, he wants the little children to come to me and I'll appreciate their like inner innocence and beauty. And oh my God, some of the songs of that vein that I heard out of this album, I just couldn't hack. And the 4th thing that he does, what have I?
Kind of disco, like airy disco pop.
Oh, probably. The 4th thing that he does is basically makes up shit. Where he writes a song, and he considers himself like a great storyteller. He writes a song where he's imagining that he's a spy, or that he's a marine saying goodbye to his lady at the port or whatever. And all of these are on...
That's the second album. I know the one you're talking about.
Yeah, what's it called? It's Paradise or something.
Something at the amazing. Gates or something. Is that the
one? I know the one you're thinking. So all of those 4 like types of song are present on Man on the Line. And all of them, I feel like whatever he's doing is justified because it sounds good and it's fun and it's catchy. Whereas on other albums, I'm like, oh man, I can't deal with the lyric. He has a lyric on one of his songs that's "Touch me with your tender mouth."
All right,
does that not
nice.
Make you feel nauseous?
Well,
it's Christa Berg.
If it's Christa Berg, yeah. Yes.
Well, it's always
the thing about it is,
if Lana Del Rey said that to me, I'd be like, no problem. But Chris, you know,
go right ahead, Lana.
But he's very, very literal in his songs. All his songs are
visceral, I would say, based on the
lyric.
Oh,
very
yeah.
Visceral.
Well, that's visceral. But he doesn't go into metaphor too much. And when he does go into metaphor, it's simple, like this is a spark to a flame or whatever. Mostly, it's there's a man on the line. He keeps calling me. he won't stop phoning me on the phone. You know, it's quite it's specific, and it doesn't use metaphor like Lady in Red, she is dancing with me cheek to cheek. It's like it's that kind of stuff, and that over the course of an album just doesn't work that much, you know. But I was surprised by how much this kind of reminded me of Phil Collins, how much of this reminded me of Brian Ferry. This I thought I would absolutely hate, and when while I do, there are there are a couple of songs. High on Emotion is a good song, you know. It's a good song.
You got
it.
It
is, it is epic.
Good song.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to get over you comparing Brian Ferry to Christopher.
No.
I might faint.
No, but the point is that this is what I was surprised by, is that there is a bit of that in here. I'm not saying that it's
okay.
The good parts of Brian Ferry. I'm saying it's stuff that leans towards that. And also, there's a thing with the album, and it's. If you were making a comedy show now, and you had a scene that was a flashback in a disco in the 80s, the music would sound like it was coming from this album. It is quite. It's all the bits of the 80s, like the funny kind of pew pew kind of keyboards and all that kind of thing. It all exists here, and the funny drum machines. And anyway, he's got one song called Sight and Touch and one song called High in Emotion, and both of those are good songs. And Tina Turner's on it apparently.
Yeah, Tina Turner is allegedly on a lot of this album, and I haven't identified her once. I was talking about that thing that he does where he's like, children, come on to me. And he, that song on here is called Sound of a Gun. And there's a bit where Tina Turner allegedly, again, it doesn't sound super like her, but she's on the credits. She's just going, hush, child. And it's incredibly creepy,
that is her.
And that's not one of the best songs in the album, but even that didn't bother me. Even that I could forgive because of the way that song sounded and because it was fun and it was up-tempo and I liked what they'd done with it.
Yeah, and it's supposed to be about, you know, children in a war zone or whatever, but I mean, that's like, is that a post thing where you write a song and you go, actually, this is about 9/11?
You know? Oh, no, I think he sits down and he's like, now I need to have one where I seem like a humanitarian. I need to have one where I talk about a woman's body.
Yeah, there's definitely a bit of that. But is it a good album? Like, I mean, this is the question.
I mean, I think it's a good, not great pop album. And I think, like Dave was saying earlier, like part of the reason for the revisit is to sort of bring something to people's attentions that they wouldn't have thought they would have liked.
Absolutely, yeah.
And this is definitely one of those. Like, if you are not interested in very broad mainstream 80s pop, you're not really going to like this. And kind of like what James was saying with you too, I really think this was his album. This is his seventh album and he hadn't really charted much. And this is the best he did with this album at that time. And I think he was very deliberately going, I need radio hits and I need them now. And I think he managed to make something really fun. And I really loved, you know, washing the dishes with this on the background.
Fun is not what I was expecting, but like I was surprised. And like that's kind of like, you know, I think three of the five records on this list fall into New Romantic territory, and I was surprised that Christopher Berg was as upbeat and out of the tracks with it on this one. Mm-hmm. Like, I threw it on first track, I was like, okay, here we fucking go. And then it was like, actually, hang on, this is actually a bit of fun. Mm-hmm. And then the problem is you get a bit of whiplash, though, because after about two or three tracks, he just brings it down. He brings it down way too early, and then you kind of get a bit of a topsy-turvy thing going on, and then by the end of the record, you're like, okay, I'm done now. Please stop talking, Chris. Okay, I get it.
Don't like Transmission Ends?
It's all right, but I think I was just kind of battered pillar to post with just the tone shifting here
and there. It isn't consistent at all.
It's so inconsistent, and like that's a massive problem. I mean, like sequencing, which was a bigger deal, I want to say, back in the 80s, because, you know, it wasn't just playlist culture, and it wasn't iPod culture, and it was the album with the album. So I was quite surprised that it was a bit all over the place in that regard. But I will say that it surprised me in a pleasant way as well. I thought it kind of worked when it worked and did not work when it did not work. But I was ready to just despise this. And the fact that I didn't is a thumbs up from me, I guess, to a degree.
No, I find it a very... I should put it like... In the same way when I had the pleasure of reviewing Christa Berg and the Gaiety, I found it very entertaining. Very cheesy. Very quiche at times. But... I wasn't looking at my watch. I didn't want it to end. I did want it to end. But, I wasn't bored out of my mind. And that was actually the concert that Peter Crawley did, the infamous review in the Irish Times, where Christa Berg was moved enough to the extent to write Peter Crawley an open letter that then was picked up on the Deborah Orr interview that was kind of done subsequently.
Which is one of the best interviews of all time.
Ever. Yeah.
To Google it immediately. So Christa Berg in 2012, I think, one of his last albums, did an interview with the UK Independent, and it tells you everything you need to know about him. it is bizarre. It is like the bit in the UK Office when David Brent is interviewed by a local paper and he basically tells them what to write. There's a bit where the journalist's name is Deborah and he keeps calling her Debbie, and she's like, please call me Deborah. And he keeps like squeezing her knee and being like, no, Debbie.
Oh, God.
It's amazing. I've written down basically the whole interview here if you'd like me to quote it verbatim for you. But it's so worth reading. It is so bizarre and surreal and amazing.
Give us an example, sure. Yeah.
Okay, here's an example. You seem like an incredibly visual person, I say. He says, I am. He then taps the side of his head. It's like a Cineplex going on in here. Which actually explains so much. Like, one of the songs on the album is him pretending to be an MI6 agent in a bar in Moscow. And the line, which I cannot let the podcast end without quoting, is, that dancing girl is making eyes at me. I'm sure she's working for the KGB.
That's brilliant.
Wow. That's pretty good.
I love that he's sure. He's sure she's working for the KGB.
No question.
He seems like he's pretty delusional. Yeah. But I think this album is a beautiful intersection for me of kind of his delusion and, you know, nice, like, it gives a good result, I think. It's the best his delusion has gotten.
Would you interview him if you're given the chance?
I think I'd be scared.
Yeah, maybe Skype or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe by email. And his conviction in his vocals in this is part of what sold it to me, especially because there's one high note on one of the ballads that he's just not hitting. Like, he's not even in the same room as this note, and he leaves it in, and I should like want to scold him for that, but I kind of like that he thought, or I hope he thought, you know,
perfect,
nailed it, the melody is better when this note remains and I'm not quite getting it, but
yeah,
I'll leave it in to serve the melody. But I'm sure he just thought, I am nailing this.
Are you still affronted by this Brian Ferry comparison, James?
A little bit, but I just because I don't know, because I love rock music.
A genius, for start. Yeah.
But I just, Chris DeBerg always just makes me think of, you know, the dude that made that film a bunch of years ago called Room or The Room?
Yes.
This crazy guy thought he was convinced he was a genius. But it's become like a cult thing. Chris DeBerg is like that in the songwriting form, where he's convinced what he's doing is amazing. And then people, and then he makes it happen. I don't know how, I don't know who's behind him telling him he's great, who's funding this or whatever. But it happens, and then he realizes his dream by becoming a massive pop star, and, you know, Princess Diana's favorite song is this Lady in Red, and he becomes this mega star, and it's almost out of force of will that he thinks he's so great, but it's just like, I admire his moxie for someone who's just patently not very good at anything he does. has made a career for himself.
Great at interviews, but it's like,
don't like his voice at all. His songs are bad. Everything just sounds like half-assed. It sounds like a big kind of, like, people are just humoring him, or like he's a rich guy and people want to be around him. But he didn't, at that stage, he wasn't like mega rich. So I'd love to know, whatever, Chris Berber, who's around him, who's his manager, who's his label, who's his musicians, who's his friends, like puffing him up into convincing him he can do this, and maybe they believe in him or something. And then he kind of proves them right, because he became massive and made a lot of money and had his big fan base. But it's to me, it's not hilarious, but it's fascinating. He's a fascinating star, someone who with patently like no talent has become this big, big thing, and people love him. His fans love him, and you know, like you're saying about kind of soft 80s kind of Loverman croony stuff, think of someone like Michael Bolton, who has an amazing voice, is like a good-looking star, and Chris DeBerg is none of that, but has the force of will to make it happen. And like only in the 80s. I can't imagine how only in the 80s that something like that. Because nowadays, Chris DeBerg would be like putting out his own music on Spotify and he'd be like his own thing. But some label signed him, and like seven albums.
It was actually
Herb
Alpert's label who signed him. Of This Guy's in Love with You fame.
Oh, God.
Which is a similar niche, you have to say.
And the Tijuana Brass. Mm. And that really annoys me because I'm a big fan of his. So, like, what's his why?
That's the
thank you, Herb. Oh, man, that's really thank
ruined,
you.
That's ruined things. But anyway, he made people happy. And that's what music should
it
be doing, I guess.
Certainly made me happy with this album.
Ringing endorsement.
Yeah, I'll be listening to this. I'll be looking for these songs on every karaoke book that I encounter over the next 10 years.
Well, I think we've sufficiently destroyed Chris de Burgh enough for one day. We'll move on
to... You might
to,
get an open letter.
I'll bring it on. No
Encore. I like podcast.
No Encore podcast, 4 or 5 Lombard
Street. Silent Touch is beautiful.
We'll move on to Silent Running and Shades of Liberty. Okay, so that's the title track there from Shades of Liberty. Solid Running, named presumably after the science fiction film of the same name, which is a fine film worth checking out. This is the debut album from a band from up north. And yeah, titled Emotional Warfare, actually, in the US and Canada, which is track 2 on this one. So, you know, with a title like that, you might expect it to be a bit emotional. And it is. And it's that kind of neo-romantic sheen that you can only get in the middle of the 80s. And before I kind of get into my thoughts on this one, I'm just curious as to what people think about the idea of... Because the bubble burst. I mean, the bubble burst with this sound. But you got to wonder, for bands in that time, did they know it was coming? Because it's very easy to sit here now and look back on it and go, my God, that sounds dated. That sounds so of its time. And it's a glorious sound. But I wonder like if a band of this nature was like, well, you know, we'll get 5 years out of this. Or if the 90s just came along and was like, see ya. I mean, like there's just a weird disparity because it's so... tied, it's so tethered. Like, you could throw this on to anybody and they'd be like, well, that's clearly made in 1985, 1984. Mm-hmm. Which is not a slight. It's real curio to me.
It's dated as food.
Yeah, that's a very short way of saying what I'm saying. Yeah.
That's what it is. It just makes it sound so of a time because it never, you know, it never developed, it never went anywhere, you know, and you had to leave that sound to go somewhere.
Yeah, which this is the thing. This is exactly the thing which like I find is that they can't leave that sound. You're so tied to a genre trope here. You're so tied to limitation. And it kind of reminds me of, like, you know, post-rock bands. People will always kind of cite the post-rock genre as being, you know, there's not a lot of places you can go with it. And when you think of bands like Exposed in the Sky and Mogwai, and, you know, at home, you think of bands like Overhead, The Albatross, and granted, at the time of recording, they're only on their first record. And I think they actually do quite a lot with their sound. But, you know, I love Exposed in the Sky. I love Mogwai. I love post-rock music. And I do think that it gets a bit of a bad rap in that regard. I think that those bands generally try and think outside the box a little bit here and there. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Granted, they can fall into a formula. But I think 80s kind of new wave and new romantic is much more... tied down, like there's such a ceiling. And unfortunately, I like this record, but I find that before the end of this record, I've heard it. Like, you're halfway through and you've heard it. Like, you're kind of like, yeah, that was really fun, that was really cool, I love the sheen on that, the production on that is gorgeous, his voice is good, like, you know, I like the arrangement. And then you're like, oh, well, here we are again by track 6 or track 7. Yeah, it's just me who kind of feels that way.
No, I got fatigue as well. Like, the first half of the album, I was like, this is, you know, great crack. And then it kind of wore off. My enjoyment of it wore off a little bit towards the kind of second half.
Yeah, and I feel kind of churlish even saying that. Like, I don't mean to bury an entire genre or the bands that made really good songs, but it's just a weird thing. It's a weird, like this is not a long record. It's like 42 minutes, and, like, you know, it doesn't necessarily outstay its welcome, but you do...
8 songs, but 3 of them are 5 or 6 minutes long. Like, true. I mean, there is a... It's very...
Samey.
Bombastic, samey.
Yeah.
Generic, I think.
Generic.
Terribly generic.
I have to say, like, I would be a lyrics person, I suppose, if that makes sense. And the lyrics in this, so it had the phrase "cuts like a knife." It had the phrase "penny for your thoughts." A wind of change is coming. Home is where the heart is. Sticks and stones will break your bones, but names will never hurt me. Keep the home fires burning.
Oh God!
You know, it's
and those are like. These are lyrics. The chorus. Yeah, those are like names of songs and lyrics it's based around.
Yeah, I've never heard anything that is so weirdly like that. It's like if they had a cuttings of famous phrases in a box in the middle of the room, and they were like, "What do we put in the chorus?" And they pulled one out, and it's like, "Oh, home is where the heart is," you know, and that's what you know, that kind of stuff. Which just I think it pushes you away from the record. You know, it's like it's like the more generic, as you said, it is. puts a barrier in between you and the album.
It's just cliche after cliche. Clichés, with the lyrics, yeah. The production, the arrangements. But bizarrely, I was kind of reading up a bit, because I, you know, this is another thing that's interesting about doing this. I was going, who the hell is that? It's like, oh, okay, right, that's some, you know, can this Belfast, you know, kind of 80s kind of thing that kind of slipped through the net. And read back kind of some of the reviews about this particular album. Got a 5-star review in Melody Maker, mm-hmm. which I find weird. Yeah. Because Melody Maker always had the reputation of being the very esoteric, kind of much more arty than the NME or Q or any, or Sounds. Or, you know, there's millions of... The music press actually meant something back then. Mm. So these were kind of critical pets in Melody Maker. Or sorry, well, one journalist in Melody Maker, yeah. which I find kind of weird to read, you know?
I mean, like, I've got another one. The American Billboard magazine put in their recommended section and said that it was U2 style wall of sound to a disco beat. And again, that's the U2 comparison, that which makes sense. Yeah. Makes
I
sense.
Hear a lot of U2 in this. I mean, I know it's New Romantic, but I do hear a lot of U2.
And Simple Minds.
And Simple
sure.
Minds. And, yeah, and like yeah. on that track, you said Emotional Warfare is Duran Duran. I wrote yes. Duran Durani. Which is kind of a weird word. But. And the thing about Emotional Warfare is it's not as bad as Actual Warfare. Emotional Warfare is bad, okay?
Okay.
But real warfare is terrible, whereas they make it sound like the actual Emotional Warfare is the worst thing that's ever happened.
I thought you were going to go into some big political statement there. I was like, where are you going with this?
No, that's what I was thinking. This for word from Belfast, you know? Like, they're talking about, you know, it doesn't... I didn't get a lot of that, you know, of, like, the amazing... kind of like insane life that they must have lived through.
Well, they have before this album came out, I think they had a single called something like if when the 12th never comes or something.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
reference to 12th of July, my birthday. But whatever, like, you know. This,
oh, you fine orange man, you.
Middle name William. Coincidence. I swear, coincidence. But like, yeah, it's this is the thing. You kind of think if they're taking their inspiration and their cues from that real life kind of horror and trauma, why is this album so, you know, standard, like we've heard it all before. I will say, like, I do like the aesthetic, though. I mean, like, you know, but then again, I think that Glenn Hoddle and Chris Waddle song is amazing. So,
but with music like this, the mid-80s new romantic East sound and big pop music, I'm always interested. I'd always be interested to know what the band is bringing to the situation before a producer and a label gets involved. If like when these guys are in a rehearsal room and someone's signing them and they sound one way, and then the label says, well, this is what we got to do to get you on the radio, and then a producer comes in and adds 50% or 20%, is it 10%? Is it all that sheen and sound and kind of something that makes them stick out is kind of pared away to make them all sound like it fits a certain mold? So it's hard to know for an album like this when you hear it, like, man, this just sounds like everything else at the time. Is there a better record under there if they just made their own record? And it wouldn't have dated as much.
But recorded, like, in Windmill Lane with the Simple Minds producer.
Okay, so there you go. Boom, boom.
Yeah.
I'd never heard of the band before the record. It was like, it was cool to know there was a band like this in Ireland making this kind of music. At least we had a kind of skin in the game. But the thing about New Romantic music is when, like, the whole kind of New Romantic movement started, late 70s, early 80s, like, it was edgy. It was weird. It was dangerous. It was kind of druggy. It was kids that would saw themselves as kind of sexual outcasts who were inspired by Bowie. And this really kind of hip, edgy thing. And within a year or two, it was completely co-opted and became this super safe sound.
Very glossy.
You know, let's have fun. Yeah. It's the 80s. Let's let our hair down. And then, like, within, like, even before the 90s, before the end of the 80s, it kind of petered out. And is it because bands like U2 kind of led the way and said, look, don't make that nonsense. Make big, important sounding, dramatic music, and it doesn't have to be all about going crazy and like yuppie pop music or whatever. So it's just they caught the tail end of it. If they'd been around 3 or 4 years beforehand.
Yeah. I mean, you say you caught the tail end, like, their last record comes out in 1989, and it's like, it feels almost like, you know, someone just closed the book on them. There's just like a general, like, okay, guys, you're not coming with us.
The Stone Roses of just the Pixies, you know.
This is it now, and you're just not invited to this party. Which, again, like, I find quite fascinating. Like, it is that kind of weird thing. I mean, I think, you know, as a document of the time, it completely fits the bill, but it's, you know, like, Selena, you know, you were saying, like, you know, even by the end, you were like, I'm fatigued. So yeah. I can't imagine this will be joining your Christa Berg washing the dishes playlist.
No, you know what? Like, if this
is
song...
Is Christa Berg washing her dishes in this...
that's
this
too theory. Creepy. That's, no, sorry. No one needs that.
Please don't ruin my relationship with Chris. if this album was the first four tracks, I probably would stick this on, washing the dishes.
If it was an EP, basically.
Yeah, if it was an EP. And I do think, actually, I don't know the name of the vocalist, but his performance I really loved. Like, I don't know, James, if what you're talking about happened with him or them being kind of pressured to do this certain kind of sound, but whatever happened, he is really singing. Like, he's very passionate, and I think he's performing like this is the best. He thinks it's the best song that's ever happened. And that was probably part of why I liked the first half of this album, as well as the kind of disco-y elements, which, I mean, I just always love.
Of course. Yeah, well, that's three kind of confident vocalists so far. We shall move on to another famous vocalist from this here nation. This is the Pogues, and this is what they sound like. Why won't you give me a couple of bucks for the old man's suspenders? Will you have a pie? Will you have a pie when you answer? And then when you toss them on a silver shack down on the Pogues on. So that's taken from Red Roses for me. Eamon Sweeney, if you've never heard a Pogues album before, is this the one to start with?
To be totally honest, no, because it's a fascinating debut album and a fantastic debut album at that. But if you're looking for a definitive Pogues album, it's Rum, Sodomy and the Lash, or If I Should Fall by the Grace of God, because they have all those amazing singles, whether it be Fairy Tale of New York, A Rainy Night in Soho. All those, the classic Shane McGowan songs are on both those albums. And I have a lot of respect, I think it's a very underrated record, is Peace and Love as well, where they attempt to do an Acid House Cayley album. And it doesn't fully work, but for the D alone. And I think there's six or seven tracks on that album, which are absolutely stunning, and the rest a bit filler. But anyway, sorry, moving back to this. I think just purely because this coming out of nowhere in 1984, you could really argue that this really kind of sent a shockwave in Irish music, both in, let's say, rock music, for want of a better word, and also traditional Irish music, akin to something like Nevermind the Bollocks by the Sex Pistols in 1978. Like something that just blew the doors open and introduced, even though this is far from being their definitive album, while it's still great and it's a great listen from beginning to end, and the songwriting is fantastic, like it introduces the talents of Shane McGowan, and you see in the beginning the realisation of someone who was without a doubt one of the best Irish songwriters ever, if not the best. You could say he's possibly the best. What's interesting here is if you kind of got, like, you're seeing the emergence of McGowan rather than the fully realised thing. So you've a lot of traditional songs in here. You've got a great version of Brendan Behan's The Owl Triangle, The Dinkle Regatta, lots of different jigs and reels and so on. And even though that's a motif on all the Pogues albums, as they go on, especially Rum, Sodomy and the Lash, what's very interesting about that is kind of like that Elvis Costello did the production on that. It was much more expansive sounding, and there's more McGowan tracks that McGowan kind of more and more crept into the mix, and they really are just then as musicians they improve from here. But the musicianship on this is still really good. If I was to fault it, I kind of go, maybe compared to the later Pogues albums, there's something a bit kind of flat about it. However, having said that, I think it really works in that way because it gives this kind of darkness to it, like The Dark Streets of London, The Boys from the County Hell, which would be one of my favourite tracks, and the first track, Metropolitan, which is going to quote the lyrics here, because I wonder if you came out with something like this in this day and age, how would it go down? I'm not going to attempt to do a Shane McGowan.
Go on.
I'd make it more of a fool of myself than I already am. So I'm going to read it like as if I'm reading poetry here.
Yeah.
As if it's this is literature, this is Seamus Heaney or something. But anyway, from Brixton's lovely boulevards to Hammersmith's slightly shores, we're scared the Camden Palace poofs and worry all the whores. There's leeches up in Whitehall and queers in the GLC, and when we've done those bastards in, we'll storm the BBC. And of course, and it's a real, and that's the first track, and there's something just so punk rock about this, and this is, it's Paddy's just really being, here we are, and like, I suppose Dexys Midnight Runners would be another kind of parallel that would have kind of a precursor to the Pogues, if you like. And Kevin Rowland and Shane McGowan are fascinating examples of songwriters who directly, address their dual nationality and all the contradictions that go with that, and all the kind of like, oh, you're a thick patty or you're a terrorist, and really explore those themes. And you, I couldn't think of two more different people, really, as in McGowan, the drinker, and then kind of Roland was very much the puritanical kind of like get people running before recording sessions and so on. But yeah, sorry, anyway, in a very long-winded way there, answering the question, is this the place to start? No. Is it a good album? Yes, it's a very good Pogues album.
But it's a funny one, though.
It's not a great Pogues album.
He doesn't. I think that the track, like, there's six covers, I suppose, five in their trad and the old triangle. Yeah. Like, the best, two of the best songs, well, three of the best songs on it, Dingle, Regatta for me, Kitty, and El Triangle were my three favourite tracks, and they're all covers or traditional.
Okay.
Uh-huh. But I like Down on the Ground and the way it just turns into a shouting match, you know.
Yeah.
I just found it a fun. One of the things that I think Shane McGowan's a great writer, and he you know, obviously in the next two albums, Rum, Sodomy Lash, and the Fourth Grace from God, but those albums, he sings throughout. And this album, he only really sings the way he sings later in Kitty and in El Triangle. And I miss that a lot. There's a lot of the kind of, it's really punky, really shout. It sounds like I imagined they would do it live.
Sure.
And it's weird. It's like, you know, it's like that. It's like they're trying to be exciting. And in the way that they're trying to be exciting, you hear the rawness of some of the vocals and stuff, but it doesn't. I don't think it translates as much. I do. Like, I found it. You know, when you go abroad and you play, you know, you're touring or whatever, and you know, if you're meeting up with people, you might meet them at the Irish bar.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And it sounds like the band in the Irish bar, as opposed to like a. Do you know what I mean? It sounds too much like someone kind of doing an impression of that.
Yeah. Sure.
For me, on that.
No, I think that's fair enough, because it's really as. We keep on repeating about this. It's kind of, it's later on that they kind of properly find their feet. I think it's both musicians and Shane as a songwriter.
It's not what a debut album is for, though, particularly if you're kind of this kind of, you know, particular nature. I mean, like, feeling it out, especially as well when you're coming out with, you know, as you say, heavyweight tracks that aren't your own. I mean, is it not more about making the statement, having a bit of attitude? I would agree with you, actually, Eamon, that, you know,
they do that totally right. Yeah, mm-hmm. No, I think I agree. And and as well, you know, there's beer glasses being clinked in throughout, and there's they're putting across their modus operandi all the way through it, you know, and, mm-hmm. and they're, I guess it's a kind of a manifesto in a way. That kind of thing is.
And I think, yeah.
But if you're talking about a good album, I mean, you can't, you're revisiting this. You can't, it doesn't exist without the other ones. You know, it exists in the world with the other albums.
Sure, absolutely.
So it's impossible to
to
kind of look at it without the other ones. And what the Pogues are, sort of, to people in the way that, like, U2, for example, what U2 are, what they became. This is like the start of it, as opposed to, you know, I don't know if, yeah, you know, it's like.
I don't know. It's my favorite Pogues album. It's one of my favorite albums ever.
Really,
I love it. I think it's of all the five we're in tonight, I think it's the best. I think it's the one that's least dated.
I agree with that.
I think it absolutely. If the Pogues broke up after this record, they would have done their job. I think it's such a touchstone record, and I think the way it sounds like a band that can't believe their luck, that someone's going to record them doing this, and we got to give everything we can. And if this all we ever do, this has to be most energetic. We have to put everything into this. It's going to sound messy. It's going to sound all over the gaff, but they did it and it captures it. And I think it's, if I would almost disagree. I think if you're going to start listening to a Pogues album, start with this. Oh. This is the door. This is it. This captures it completely. The songwriting gets better. The recordings get better as time goes on. He's clearly like a genius songwriter, but this, you can't, like, I listen to this record a lot just in life, just walking around, just if whatever mood I'm in, I put it on, like, this will make me feel better, regardless of what, if I'm feeling, if whatever, especially when I'm on tour for years touring, this one record I listen to, I'm like, right, let's do it, let's just, whatever's going on, let's just go for it, because it sounds like the most fun record to make. It sounds like they had a great crack making it, and they didn't care. They're like, we'll just make it, we'll do what we do, sounds like, uh-huh. I think an album like this, a band like this, I can't imagine. If someone hears this album, they won't love it and won't go, wow, who is this band? This is incredible. And then in you go, next few records, songs get better, they get more well known, like, he sings more, whatever it might be. But this is just like, it's just like, it captures them at just the moment where, obviously, because he'd been in the Nips, he'd been in punk bands before, he was looking for his vehicle.
The Young Republicans was the last
I think one, yeah. He had to capture this thing, and it feels like it might go off the rails all the time, and I love that. I just think it's, but it's, you know, one of it, I think it's one of the top five Irish albums ever.
Wow.
I think it's wow. just, I think it's a phenomenal record, and I can't, and as although the next two records maybe have better songs or just had more went into it and, you know, they grew as a band, this is just like, it's listening to it again, I hadn't heard it in like a couple of weeks or a couple of months actually until we were listening for this this podcast, and then I just like, my God, how have I not heard this in the last week or 2 weeks? This is wow. I need to have this okay. all the
it
time.
It means a lot to you, this record.
Yeah, I just love it. Yeah. I love it, and that's partially why I didn't want to be the one doing the main review of it, because it's like, just whatever they do, this is golden.
You would have talked twice as long as I did.
Yeah, so. Yeah. But I can see. I mean, even the versions of, like, you hear them doing the old triangle. That's it. That's the, yeah. to me. That's a quintessential well, version.
That is a great.
You can't. That's yeah, like yeah, yeah, yeah. anyone who does it. More modern bands, I'm not going to name, do awful versions, and it's all this kind of reverential nonsense. Like, this is a song written to be sung like that, but replayed is, like that,
and the song Waxy Dargle, and the thing.
Yeah,
the
same thing.
But it's like, I always thought it was funny how they were like screaming the lyrics at each other, you know. Oh, I'm a pirate, yeah, you know. And I just thought it was funny, and so I didn't know how to take it, I think, because it's almost like they don't care and they're just shouting it out. And I don't know, I do agree though, you can't ignore it, you know.
No.
It's like it does affect you.
There's so much energy in it, like.
I read this thing on, this is one of the first examples of something going viral. It was the song Waxy Dargle.
Yeah.
Because they did it on The Tube, which was a TV show in the 80s, a show called The Tube. Mm-hmm. And he was hitting his head, Spider Stacy was hitting his head with a beer tray, doing percussion all the way through. And it became something that everyone kept asking to listen to again and again and watch again. So they kept playing it, you know. And so, like, it's like, that's what happens now, you know. People like see a clip and they go mental. And it's like, that was one of the things that, like, broke them, you know, and they were talking about releasing it as a single afterwards to push the album and all. But isn't
but
it like
it's one thing with traditional Irish music in general is there's always this, when this kind of search for proficiency, and let's get really good at the tin whistle, really good at our instruments, and it sucks all the life out of it, because I think you can get to the point where it's played so well, it's kind of antiseptic. And with the Pogues, they could play just enough to get across what they wanted to get across.
Punk rock.
Like, I think, I mean, there's a whole genre of music now, like Dropkick Murphys, all that stuff that's into like Celtic punk and has that vibe to it, but they can't capture that. You can't capture that, and you can't. You know, I don't know how long this record took to make. It could have been a day, it could have been a week, but to me, it's almost like a lot of my favorite like hip hop records, I'm thinking like Illmatic or something, where Nas went in to make that, and it was like, look, this could be it. This is my one shot to maybe tell my story, and I've got to get across what I want to get across. And he made it, and it's like one of the greatest albums ever. But then he made a bunch of other records which are really good, but he never seemed to be able to capture that again. And I think although the next few Pogues records might actually be better albums technically, with better recording, better songs, they just never capped it. This is a thing. This is like an artifact. If someone was gonna say, well, like, what's Irish music sound like to you? It's like, that's what I want Irish music to sound like.
Mm-hmm. Selena, based on what James said earlier, did you love it? Did you go, wow?
I was just thinking there when you were saying about how they weren't, like, at their most proficient or whatever. Like, I'm someone who loves proficiency in music, and I love polished, shiny things. Mm-hmm. And when I heard this, and I didn't have a personal reaction to it, and the Pogues are a struggle for me to listen to because it's not a sound that I just naturally love, but I did think, wow, and I thought the energy on this is amazing. Like, it's kind of magical, like the vibe they create on this. And I mean, you have to give it up to anyone who's like, lads, will we just scream for 30 seconds at the end of this track?
That's right, yeah.
Won't that be funny? Like, they've managed to make like something that has this really unique feeling to it that I really liked. And I mean, it's not something I'm going to be listening to all the time, but it's definitely a great album.
Energy
was the word that just kept coming into my head. Like, they must have been sweating buckets making this.
Uh-huh.
Sweating buckets and well lubricated, I'm sure.
Like. Oh, I'm sure.
But there is, under all that and all the cliches about the drinking and all the madness and so on, as a statement of intent, Even the, take the cover of this, that the way that they're posing, it's around this kind of this portrait of JFK. It's like that kind of, you know, 1960s Irish living room. But Carter Reardon's there with a fag and, you know, a bottle of beer or something, or
there's
a can of beer.
Out of coats
and you see, like, you know, and the fact that, you know, it's a girl in this band as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's a fascinating person, like, as well. And her punky energy is the basis of what she brings to this. Like, and you could argue, you know, that kind of, when she left subsequently, like, they may have got bigger and had bigger hits, but they lost their punk rockness, I suppose, in a way you could say, you know?
And it's strange to think they got as big as they got, and that Fair Tale New York is the song that it is from the band that they started as. Yeah. Like, no, how will this band ever become, like, ever get on the radio, ever be, like, if you describe what was going to happen in the following 5 or 6 years of their career, like, no, that's not going to happen.
Well, let's see if James is as passionate about our final record on this episode. This is Micro Disney, and Everybody Is Fantastic. Disney, talk to us.
So when I was younger and started music, obviously you kind of grow up when you're young in bands, you're kind of cynical about what's around. And I always used to say that, like, older friends of mine, Ireland never has any cool bands or whatever. And one of the first bands they said was like, no, we used to have really cool bands, was a band called Micro Disney, who were really cool, really great, you should check them out. So this is when I'm like 16, 17 years old, and I went back in, and at the time I thought, oh, this is just like nonsense, it sounds too 80s. But over the last 5, 6, 7 years, when you kind of revisit them, you realize what a great band they were, what the great records that they made. I mean, this isn't one of their great records. This isn't like their pivotal, like their two really, really great records are A Clock Comes Down the Stairs, which is like critically acclaimed, as every Irish music critic regards it, in one of the best Irish albums ever. And then Crooked Mile, which was the first record they made when they signed to a major label. But when they started out, Two guys from Cork, Kyle Coughlin and Sean O'Hagan, starting out, decided to kind of avoid going to Dublin, because at the time in the early 80s, Dublin was buzzing because of U2, and it was very, I guess, kind of like everyone was patting everyone on the back, and just quite insular. So they went straight to London as part of their story too. Two lads from Cork moving to London, like living the life of like expats in a band, kind of grim. Always, their music always seems like it's raining outside, like they're not eating well, they're always wearing like jumpers, they're drinking too much, and
soggy from rain.
Just what
jumpers.
I imagine the early 80s in London was like for indie musicians. Because the other thing about Micro Disney is, I think they were the first Irish band to sign to Rough Trade. So straight away they're like, I think they were like 83.
Stiff Little Fingers, I think. Look, they won the first two or three.
Yeah,
let's put
so
that.
So that's
way,
like
that's
straight away, like a band on a cool label. Jeff Travis signing like the Mr. Cool indie music. So there was obviously something there. So when I started, I wasn't as familiar with this record. I knew the other two way better. So when I started listening, you could see what they were going to become. It's a dour listen. A lot of it is quite dour. They haven't quite found the balance between Kyle Coughlin's really great lyrics, but very down and kind of heavy. There's a lot of heaviness. Songs about drinking, loneliness, you know, being alone, not finding love, you know, the state of the world. And then Sean O'Hagan's making all this kind of nice pop music to go around it, and it doesn't quite work. Some of the songs on the record, there's a song called Moon, which is just a beautiful song. It just happens in the middle album.
Yeah, Moon.
It's
is a
gorgeous.
Great song.
And it kind of almost sounds like I don't know, kind of
David Bowie singing to.
Yeah, it has a kind of Bowie vibe, or like Talk Talk or something.
Everybody sings a song with the little fat man.
Oh, that's great.
There's a lyric in that. It's like, really? Little fat man lives on the moon. I was like,
I'm trying to think of that. Scottish band. Oh my God, Paul Buchan's the singer.
Oh, the Blue Nile.
Blue Nile. So it almost has that kind of airy keyboardy sound. And Kyle Coughlin, because it's such a deep voice, kind of like baritone and the world, blah blah blah,
and a strong accent.
Yeah, and when the music is too light, it doesn't blend. you know, and yeah. I think in this record it just doesn't blend right all the way through. I think the dude that produced it was the Smiths producer. You know, they're maybe trying to go for Smiths pop, but Kyle Coughlin's a different lyricist to Morrissey, big time, different kind of voice, and it just doesn't mesh properly as an album for that reason, that they haven't seemed to figure out what their sound is going to be. But then on the next record, Clock Comes Down the Stairs, which is just epic, it just clicked, you know, that the songs are almost in a different key. They found the right kind of tempo for what they were trying to write. He seemed to be able to sing better. His lyrics are still incredible, but just not kind of feeling sorry for himself. And then what came after, they signed to a big label, and they kind of got gobbled up by their major label and stuff. But it's interesting to hear a band that the record before the classic record, you know, mm-hmm. and being able to listen to it as a fan, knowing where they're gonna go, how they got there, you know, what's the kind of the little spark within this record that kind of is a signpost of what they're about to do. And because the jump in quality between the two records is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. To go from a kind of pretty average debut album that's kind of dated, like big 80s drums, synths for no reason, guitars don't sound very good, he's not singing like he should be, there's too much lyrics to, within the space of a year, make like a classic record. So they obviously were just worked really hard and, you know, found themselves, but
Are the vocals a touch overwhelming though?
High in the mix, and he's like,
how much that is mixing though, and how much that is his style?
I think it's him kind of saying like, you know, without this, our music's not going to have enough weight to it. So loads of vocals, and I need to really feel sorry for myself singing these words, and you know, and it's
the lyrics sometimes. I think the lyrics are great, and I love that he was doing different stuff with the lyrics, and they're very descriptive. They're literal. It's not literal. They're
literary.
Literary, yeah. And I think that's brilliant. But I think that sometimes it makes it quite clunky, and sometimes you want it to flow better, and it doesn't as a result. But when
there's too many songs on the record, it's like there's too much, like meh.
But when they nail it, like that song "Sun" is brilliant. Yeah. The chorus for "Idea," which is the first track in the album, the song itself is okay, but the chorus is fantastic.
I was trying to think
of like a modern band that has that kind of a singer, like The National or Tinderstick, someone who sings in that kind of range.
Spies here in Dublin?
Yeah, just kind of like, or like, if you go for that kind of, like, Editors or some, this kind of big, or Interpol, singing down. And
the baritone.
And that only works with a certain kind of sound around it and a certain tempo. And they obviously didn't want to be that. Didn't want to be like this dancey band. And I always sometimes feel as well with some of the songs in this record that the lyrics are amazing. His performance is like really weighty, and the music's so lightweight compared to it. Doesn't sound right.
Yeah.
A lot like musically, it's of all the records we're listening to, it's the most dated sounding, even more than Silent Running. It really sounds like.
Didn't know what to go that quite that far. Silent Running is pretty.
I don't know. Like some of the drums, the choices. Again, if the Micro Disney record had been released, just as a band entering record without a producer doing whatever he did, shining it up, it wouldn't have dated as much, and it would have been a better record.
There is some keyboard sounds.
I just wish fans had done that in the 80s, because the records that have aged the best out of the 80s are the ones that weren't made on major labels necessarily, for rock bands anyway, the kind of indie bands that didn't want to go for that kind of sound. The drums sound like drums, guitars sound like guitars, there's not all pointless keyboards sucking all the texture out of the music. So I don't know, I Clock Comes Down the Stairs still sounds like a very 80s record, but it's just a better album, and it suits them better.
You said something there which is really interesting. You said it sounds like an album before, like a seminal album of theirs. But that's really funny, because the Pogues, you know, after that was Run Sodomy and The Lash, obviously after Unforgettable Fire was the Joshua tune.
I just checked
there on my phone. After Christopher Berg's Man on the Line, was Into the Light,
which was Lady in Red.
And looking at the numbers across the like, it's like number one, number two, and number 25 in the States.
This is spooky.
This is the transition year, just before everybody's most iconic work.
But the jump that all the other bands made isn't as big as Micro Disney made. I think Micro Disney improved by like 70% between their records, whereas the other bands got better a little bit. Better songs, bigger production, whatever. But Micro Disney, when you hear the two records side by side, it's phenomenal how they went from a pretty run of the mill, average, early 80s sounding, kind of moody pop record to like. And the next two albums, even the one after Clock Comes Down the Stairs, is another brilliant record. Yeah. Has like a Town to Town on it and stuff. I think the single they released between the first album, the second album is Birthday Girl, which is one of like a great Irish song. It's a beautiful song.
That's but on.
There's,
that's
there's
on
nothing
the
that
album.
Even that is, sniffs yeah. that on the first album. Quality of song. Yeah,
but Dolly is a really good song.
It is, but that, and that was the single.
That was the single.
And you imagine that as a single. By,
but I was thinking like, that's why it was. This, do you know what I mean? It made sense because it flowed the best. Mm. It didn't have the. It wasn't the best song in the album.
No.
And the album really took for me. This album took like just it was, I found it quite impenetrable.
Yeah,
I found it difficult. I was like, this is hard to get the feeling of.
Yeah,
and I think it might be quite a. I think it's a patchy album.
Yeah, for sure. It doesn't sound like living in London near the 80s for those guys was particularly fun.
Yeah, like
I think
there's
the
a line,
soggy
the literal lover,
like how like, bad was Cork in the early 80s? They had to leave to go to London. You
soggy
know?
Jumper is like the perfect
yeah,
metaphor
yeah.
of Big this
song.
Album
That's
for
the
me.
Vibe.
Because
yeah. it's like.
I
singing
just,
a squash or somewhere.
Like
yeah.
I
yeah.
found some of the melodies and to be just gorgeous. And every time I was like kind of riding the wave of like, oh, he's doing something so nice here. His voice and the just weight and like, I mean that in a negative
yeah,
way, like the
absolutely.
Way that he sounds like he's like in a terrible way or hungover or something. Really made me like he brought me crashing down to earth from the high that he had already brought me up yeah. on with the melody.
Because it always
it's pessimistic as well.
It is, mm-hmm. and it just always makes me think of young people, guys and girls living in London in the early 80s, working to emigrating. Oh, it's a real downtime, and you've got the Pogues, got U2, you got Micro Disney making music, like two bands based in London. You know, and what it must have been like to be 21, 22, living in London at the time and clinging to this is the bands from home, going to the gigs in like the town and country club in Kentish Town or whatever, and kind of with all other Irish people. And I've seen footage of Pogues gigs from the time, and it just looks like the most incredible experience. Everyone just like coming together.
Mm.
Oh, is a Micro Disney gig kind of people kind of yeah. like, feeling a bit down. But that's, it's like, it's, they're a fantastic band. And Kyle Coughlin, again, like Shane again, one of our like greatest songwriters. Lyrically, like when he went on to form Fatima Mansions, they're an incredible band as well. They have more records than Micro Disney. And they've another bunch of really classic album, really brilliant music. And he seems like a fascinating dude and a fascinating songwriter and fascinating lyrics and what's going on in his head. But at the time, here's an opportunity, make an album. What have you got to say for yourself? He doesn't feel like he's kind of figured out what he needs to say. He's kind of letting it all out. There's one song about when he's meeting, he meets a girl, she's a bit older than him. I think it's called Liberal Girl.
The Liberal Lover.
And it's like heavy. And then they break up and it's just like, and it sounds like it's coming from him. And that might have happened. And God, like bad times. Like bad vibes, early 80s. I can think of Christa Berg fans are like cruising around in their... in their fancy cars and it's all
top
like
down
yuppie time, and then you Pasta have shirts. Someone like music for different people, one's a major label, one's an indie, like
sure.
it sounds yeah, like yeah. it should be on Rough Trade, and it sounds yeah. like maybe Jeff Travis signed him, was like, oh, these can be like my Irish version of the Smiths,
the Peel sessions, they
yeah.
loved, didn't they, John
Peel
loved
them
yeah,
and
yeah,
it
yeah,
totally
yeah.
makes sense. John yeah. like Rough Trade, John Peel loves them
yeah, yeah, yeah.
like it can't get any cooler than that, any hipper, but at the time it meant nothing to them because they were living in not very nice place in London and it's grim and heavy going, and maybe that's they had to suffer, but I don't know.
Well, we'll try our very best to pick, you know, the most essential listener of this five. It's been a very contentious and very interesting rundown this time, I think, so we'll take a quick break and we'll come right back. Okay, so yeah, perhaps more so than usual on the show, it's nothing's really jumping out. I mean, like, what I would say is I wish the Silent Running album was an EP. I wish the Christa Berg album was an EP. Like, that would make my job so much easier here. As a result, just due to general process of elimination, I can't believe I'm saying it, but fucking U2. I have to go U2.
I cannot the best album believe here. You've done this. Okay, so U2 are your shout.
They're my shout. James.
I think the Pogues, listen to it. Just it's the best record Irish band put out that, even though they're an Anglo-Irish band that put out that year, and it's essential. And if you haven't heard it before, you need to hear it. You need to own it.
I will do a joint vote between the Pogues and U2. I'm sorry. They're not, neither of them are the gold standard of My Bloody Valentine's Loveless, but they're still amazing and I think incredible documents in Irish music. So, those two.
I'm going to go for, I think I'm going to go for U2. But actually, yeah, I think U2 probably said, I didn't love a lot of the albums on this list, but I think the album that I liked the best as well as you do, so that's okay. my rationale.
Fair enough.
Well, I have a very sincere love for Man on the Line. But I, the one thing I'll say about that, to call back to Brian Ferry, is that this is the album for me that proves that Chris de Burgh is not Brian Ferry, but he's maybe like an inch closer to Brian Ferry than I would have thought, and probably the same of everyone listening. So I do think it's worth a listen. But it is, you know, it's not an iconic like touchstone of Irish music. I would have to vote for the Pogues. I just love the energy on there. It's not something I will be listening to all the time, but it's definitely the album I think I could most broadly recommend to people, because there's a really cool vibe about it.
Yeah, that's fair. I think that's a fair shake up. So
should we have a tie, I think, or what?
We have a tie between you two and the Pogues.
Which so is fine. We've had
that's a fair draw.
Yeah, that's a fair draw.
That's exactly, I concur with that, yeah.
Who'd win in a fight?
That's
a tiebreaker. Yeah.
Well, in a fight with anyone.
Pretty much.
Looking at Shane's kind of health at the moment, yeah. I think Bono would be a bit more agile than Shane.
I don't know.
Put it that way, you know.
I don't know, so. He had his arm all messed up.
Oh yeah, that's right.
He's got a bad elbow.
That's right, yeah.
Go on the elbow. Yeah.
Although Adam Clayton is ripped.
So they're both.
He's like, Adam Clayton's properly torn up. For like a dude in his 50s, he's sculpted.
Is it really?
For real.
I wouldn't want to take a punch off Larry Mullen either, to be fair.
That is true.
I'd say just ruffle his hair and
he'd be
go
the
down
one of the like four, I would say. Because historically as well, he's kind of like, in many ways, he is the kind of the end. Even Bono is the mouth.
Yeah.
But Larry's always the guy telling the Bono, muscle. Shut the fuck up. The, like, you know, kind
of. Cigarette behind his ear as he kicks the shit out of you. You know, it's like, I don't want to be there. I think that's a fair result. What I would say, though, is before we wrap up, I would say that I think the Pogues should play us out simply due to James's passion on the subject, which was very admirable. But yeah, I mean, like, a strange year, a big year in many, many ways.
Can I just mention, I think it's worth bearing about, just given that just before Christmas that Frank Murray died, who was obviously he managed the Pogues, but not only did he manage the Pogues, he managed Thin Lizzy and indeed people like the Mighty Steff. And I know loads of people, all sorts of artists and designers and characters around town that had just so much love and respect for that man, and he really was up until the day that he died, how should I put this the best way, like, he really believed in being an enabler, in enabling great art, and so anyway.
Yeah, actually, I remember I met him in my Hot Press days. Lovely man. I remember when the Lost Brothers played at a Levon Helm tribute night, and I remember saying to him, I was like, they're really good. And like, he lit up like a Christmas tree. Like, he was so happy for his charges. Yeah, like, he was very much like, he was like, weren't they? Oh, they're great, aren't they? Yeah. And like, there was just such genuine conviction about the man. So yeah, absolutely. Rest in peace, Frank Murray. He was a hell of a guy. But thank you all for coming in today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Traveling back in time, 32, almost 33 years. Reminder of my age there for everybody listening. And yeah, so to play us out this week, James, what Pogue song are we listening to?
Maybe The Old Triangle, because I'm about to walk home in the rain and it's dark. and I live near
I live
near a canal. I live near the Grand Canal, but, you know, it's still a canal.
So this, yeah.
Good call, we'll do it. My name is Dave Hanready. This has been No Encore. This has been The Revisit. We'll be back to you again soon. And this is The Pogues and The Old Triangle, the definitive version. Thank you.
Sorry for the interruption. Just before we played the song by The Pogues, Kieran got Cathal Reardon from The Pogues on the phone for a quick chat. Cathal Reardon, this is Kieran giving you a shout from The Revisit. Headstuff's The Revisit, and our album of 1984, To Revisit, was Red Roses for me. So I'm just wondering if we can have a little chat about that. How does that suit you?
Go for it. I'll tell you anything I can remember, which might not be much.
So it's the first album of the band, and I guess 13 tracks and 6 similar covers. Was it a long writing process up to that, or did it just feel like it just, you know, it just happened overnight?
My memory of it is we rehearsed a lot, and Shane would show up to rehearsals and he'd have bits of paper with the songs written out, and he'd play guitar and sing them through to us, and we'd just pile in and make them that way.
Do you think there was a kind of a thought into what you were doing, or was it just kind of, did it feel a bit wild when you were writing the songs?
A caution? Is that the word you use?
No, like, was there a kind of did you feel like you were planning it, like how you know together how you wanted it to sound, or did it just kind of was it a kind of just
oh
a
my
wildness?
God, yeah, I mean, Shane, at the time, now this is what you young people well, no, at the time we didn't have access to all the music in the world. You knew what you were raised with, and you knew what you heard on the radio, which was, you know, a finite number of channels. and you knew what you saw on Top of the Pops, which was 30 minutes one day a week. So we weren't overwhelmed with music, and you kind of, you were formed by the music you had access to and the music you were exposed to. You didn't get to pick and choose. But the thing now where people are, you know, they put on a waistcoat and grab a banjo and they act like they're Appalachian, but really they're from, you know, a suburb of Manchester or Galway. And at the time, where you were from was a very definite thing, and we were very much London Irish. And Shane was completely the product of being a London Irish punk who would go out and see the Sex Pistols and the Clash, but then he'd go home and he'd listen to the Dubliners or the Clancy Brothers. And I think that's just exactly what the Pogues were. It was the punk energy built on a very solid ground of kind of popped up ballads.
Yeah, there's, I mean, that's what, I mean, that's a lot of things that we were saying. You know, it's kind of like very punky, very, very traddy. And I guess some of the highlights of the album, apart from the obvious ones, are some of the covers. How did you decide which covers to do? Like, or was it just they were the ones that you did live and it came together that way?
Yeah, whatever would go over live. I think if it was a trad song that we all enjoyed and that would go over well, because, I mean, we started in the back room of a pub in King's Cross, and if it would go over well to that audience, and if Spidey could bash his head with a tea tray to it, and then it was in.
Yeah, the video from The Tube is something we were mentioning earlier on when he was playing percussion on his head with a tray. I think one of the obvious kind of things that people would talk about the Pogues is the kind of drinking culture. Did you feel that, like, you know, were they drunken sessions, or was it, you know, pretty kind of organized in that way, or was it just the kind of thing where there wasn't any organization, just whatever happened?
It's so racist. It's so fucking ignorant British racism, that whole idea. You know, every band I ever met, this is growing up in London and working in London, drank. And, you know, every band had a sloppy drunk, whether they were English, Irish, American, French, whatever. But, you know, talking about 1980s, Thatcher's Britain, the fact that you were Irish or you had Irish heritage and you then it was just old drunken paddies, it's fucking nauseating.
Yeah, I'd say it can be very easily leveled, I guess. You came from quite a punk background as well. Maybe, you know, it was mentioned earlier on that you brought like a lot of the punk energy into the band, where as some of the other musicians might have brought, you know, maybe the trad side of things. Did you feel that was the case, or again was it, you know?
At the time, I didn't analyze any of it. I thought we were a folk band because we were playing the Dubliners and Clancy Brothers songs, and I was, you know, that's what I used to listen to, you know, and variations of. I liked English folk bands as well. I like any songs about, you know, fishing, whaling, being a pirate, fighting, you know, big horse fairs. Songs like that are always good to listen to. And murder ballads, all that stuff. But it was, they wouldn't have been classified as punk in any way. I think the punk energy I bought was just being a teenager and not knowing what I was doing. So it was just massive adrenaline going the whole time.
So after this was released, there was a bit of a time between the next album. Was that time spent just gigging and touring, or was it a kind of, I don't know, I can't imagine what it was like, you know, touring at that time, but was it mostly touring, or was it kind of just people went off and did their own thing for a while?
Not at all, no, tour. We had to tour, which was fantastic. I mean, the first 2 years in the band, I don't think we left London, and then suddenly we were wanted, you know, we got attached to a national artist national tour, so we got to see how, you know, the real bands with record company support did it. you know, people who had tour buses and stuff. I mean, we were in a van going up and down the M1. But it was great to see how it was done. And we're getting Shane was obviously, you know, a big star within the small world of the London music press. And like you saw the Tube, you know, we'd go up to Newcastle and do the music press. And we got our first European tour when the first album came out. So, yeah, I mean, I really don't know how the music industry works for new bands these days. But at the time, you'd make an album, that would be you announcing your existence. And if people liked it, then everything snowballs from there. You know, you start getting media attention, you get a bit of heat. Suddenly agents and promoters are interested in you, and the media are interested in you, and everything just accumulates at once.
Yeah, I think one of the things that, you know, I guess everyone kind of talked about from that album was the energy, was the kind of, I guess, the passion that comes across. And, you know, there is a lot of humour in it as well. Some of the singing, especially in stuff like Waxy Dargle, like, you know, it's almost comic, you know, how kind of, it just sounded like a lot of fun, you know. When you moved on to, you know, Rum, Sodomy and the Lash and stuff like that, you know, you're now singing on some of the songs on Rum, Sodomy and the Lash, like I'm a Man, You Don't Meet Every Day and stuff like that. Did you feel like your kind of presence in the band, you know, became, you know, stronger in that time? Or did you feel that it was a kind of thing where it was a very kind of democratic, diplomatic kind of procedure? That sounded very official.
No, I mean, we had a lot of... Go ahead.
I was just saying that sounded like a very official question, didn't it?
I was going to say, I mean, you used the word democratic there, and that was a big tension in the band a lot of the time, obviously, because Shane was so obviously just a gift. You know, what a writer, what a singer, what a presence. And I know that I looked to him as my leader, and I think everyone did, which put a lot of pressure on him. And he would always say, no, you know, the band's a democracy. But, I mean, would always come up when there were interview requests, because everyone wanted to talk to Shane. And Shane was the songwriter and, you know, this amazing character. And it put a lot of burden on him. You know, if you have to write the songs and do all the talking about them, but then go out and do all the work as well, you know, do all the touring and whatever, put a lot of pressure on him. And he didn't want all that pressure on him. He tried to spread it around. But, you know, him saying we're a democracy and talk to the others in the band, you know, the NME isn't going to put me or the banjo player on the front cover. So... He wanted it to be a democracy, but, you know, reality dictated it couldn't be a democracy.
Yeah, especially with a personality like that in the band. Well, thank you very much for talking to us here. I really, really appreciate it. And we'll put this interview out with the podcast. And hopefully I'll talk to you again soon.
That's great, Kieran. I hope people give the album a listen and that they enjoy it.
Definitely. Thank you very much, Koch.
Thanks, Kieran.
Grey Phelan came army stealing, and the mice were squealing in my prison cell. And I'll triangle when jingle jangle all along the banks of the Royal Canal. Oh, to start the morning, the water bowling, get up out of bed, you, and clean out yourself, and that old triangle when jingle jangle all along the banks of the Royal Canal. Oh, the screw was peeping and the light was sleeping as he lay weeping for his girl's soul. And that old triangle went jingle jangle all along the banks of the Royal Canal. On a fine spring evening, the lake lay dreaming, and the seagulls were wheeling high above the wall. And that old triangle went jingle jangle all along the banks of the Royal Canal. Oh, the wind was sighing and the day was dying as the lake lay crying in his prison cell. And that old triangle went jingle bloody jangle all along the banks of the Royal Canal. In the women's prison there are 70 women, and I wish it was with them that I did dwell. Then that old triangle could go jingle jangle all along the banks of the Royal Canal.
This has been a production of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.